everybody. Welcome to Drive Through HR. Brian, William, and Nisha coming to you live every day talking about HR with people who love HR. So we definitely have a treat today. We had a little bit of a glimpse and spent some lunch with some global HR conversations. So let's get right to it. So welcome, Anita the Think, to Drive Through HR.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here, and it's nice to talk to all of you.
If you would, introduce yourself to our little family, drive-through HR, and then we'll jump right into it.
Yes. So my name is Anita Letting. I was born and raised in the Netherlands, lived in several countries like Germany and also the U.S. I have a background in technology, and in 2001 I moved into the HR space when I joined what is now called NGA HR, Human Resources, but was then called Arinzo. I am at this point governing the or leading the Northern Europe region for NGA, advising clients on their global HR and payroll strategies. And it's a very fun job.
So Northern Europe, for us Americans, we probably could not pick that off the map, or at least name two or three countries in Northern Europe. So if you don't mind, for the neophytes over in the West, what exactly makes up Northern Europe?
Northern Europe, it's not specific, a definition of, it's just a set of countries that we define as Northern Europe, which is the Netherlands, then the Nordics, which is Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and Finland, and then the Baltics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania.
All right, I got to ask you, favorite city in Europe, what is it?
Rome.
Really? Huh.
Really?
Why? Yeah, no, I'm Vienna's mine. So there's mine. Brian, what's your favorite city in Europe?
Oh, it's I've had limited travel, so I would probably say, you know, Oxford, actually in the I guess, you know, we'd still consider, for those who haven't traveled as much in Europe or ever, that something in England is still Europe, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
Work with me here. So I love Oxford. Oxford was an amazing place.
Oh, no, it's absolutely, it's Europe. Especially we mainlanders consider the UK as part of Europe. I think in the UK sometimes they might view that a little bit differently. But, yes, it's part of Europe. It's part of the European Union. So you have a perfect city chosen.
So, all right, so you're working with NGA HR.
Damn it.
I got you. Yeah, I think we need to get some Brits on the phone because I'm pretty sure they don't really consider themselves a part of that whole thing.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we digress.
Yeah.
Anita, if you can, I want to ask you the question of what's keeping you up at night. And I want to do that two ways, both what's keeping you up at night with all the of the things that you manage for NGA HR, but also what's keeping your clients up at night. What do you see from your clients day in and day out?
Yeah. So if you look at NGA HR, where I spend, you know, most of my days and most of my time, I think what is keeping us up at night at this moment in time is to figure out what is going to happen in the HR space. If you would have asked me this 3 or 4 years ago, I could have given you a very specific, very definite answer. But last year in January, the world changed a bit for all of us in the HR tech space when SAP acquired SuccessFactors, Oracle acquired Taleo, and of course Workday came onto the market. And suddenly the whole tech strategy changed from on-premise ERP to let's move to the cloud and, you know, fulfill all our technical requirements in the cloud. But of course, customers cannot move overnight from one solution to the other, and they have current current systems, current solutions, and what are they now going to do with the investments that they had? Should they move to the cloud? On top of that, and this might sound a bit strange for Americans, but people here worry about what is going on with the NSA. As you know, we Europeans have a thing, and that is called data privacy, and we're sort of strict about it. So that is, you know, moving from what's keeping me up for NGA at night to moving what keeps our customers up. What is foremost on the minds of our customers is how can they move to support their global workforce with a global HR system and solution, and how do they keep all, how are they going to keep all of that aligned and be compliant in all the countries where they operate, and making sure that things like data privacy and data security are taken care of.
Let's back up for a second, and some here in the States might not be as familiar with NGAHR. What exactly do y'all provide? What's the services and software array?
Yeah, so we provide, we call it IP-led HR services to our customers, and our customers are predominantly enterprise customers who operate on a global scale. And then in several countries or regions in the world, we also provide services to mid-sized companies and small enterprises. I work predominantly with enterprise customers because in my region, we do not offer this bespoke solution for the mid-sized companies.
When people are looking at the cloud versus on-premise, there's obviously applicability for both. How do you usually have that conversation with folks? Is, you know, it makes sense if you're to do on-premise if it looks like this. It makes sense to go to the cloud if it looks like this. Like, where, in your experience, where does it make sense for the solution to be on-premise, and where does it make sense for it to be cloud?
Yeah. What you see with ERP today is that, especially in Europe, many customers have ERP HR systems that have been in place for years, fulfill all their wishes, and especially when it comes to compliancy, legal compliancy, in the area of workforce administration, payroll, time, health and safety, let's say all the basic processes that you are required by law to provide. But, of course, there is a strong focus now on talent management and things like workforce planning, making sure that you have a good view of the skills and capabilities of your workforce. And that is usually not where the ERP systems are the strongest, or those processes are not as well developed in the current ERP systems that our customers have. So once you start looking at that, it is an easy step to talk to customers and, you know, propose cloud system. But inevitably, it leads to the discussion, then what will we do with what we have? Because it's not a sound business case for most companies to throw that all away and start all over. So talking to customers, figuring out what makes sense to keep, where you need to a move to a different solution, if you need to move everything you have to that different or new solution and then go into the cloud, it's a case-by-case base. There is never an easy answer at this point in time.
What's the HR practitioner? Go ahead, finish your thought.
I think that one of the things that I would like to add is that what you see is the HR cloud systems are coming out of the U.S., and so while they are very good for supporting U.S. processes, U.S. transactions, it's now slowly that these cloud vendors are starting to introduce localized versions for the European space. So it will take a little bit of time before we can, you know, very confidently say to customers, look, you can move everything you have in every jurisdiction where you operate to a cloud system and it will support you no matter what. We are not there yet.
What? Yeah, I actually want to dig into the process of moving from one to the other. Where do you see the unforeseen, which is always what happens in consulting, is that you can all the foreseen stuff's pretty easy. It's the unforeseen that kind of like, oh, we didn't know that existed, etc. That's the stuff that kind of bites you. Moving from on-premise to the cloud. What are some of the things that people, as they're considering it or as they're thinking about it, what's some of those learns that y'all have had over the last couple of years?
I think that what you really need to do is make the case for change within your company, because very often what you see is there's an HR team and they advise the executives on a new solution, and they have this business case, and it all looks great, and they say go. And then, you know, we get asked to join them and carry out the project, and then suddenly you have to go to all these local HR departments and explain to them that, yes, this was decided, and we are now going to move your local solutions to a cloud solution. And then, of course, you get into these discussions like, but we've always done it this way, and it needs to operate this way in the future, where cloud is actually very good if you are able to standardize on a global level or, let's say, on a regional level. The second thing is that companies do not actively think about what to do with their legacies, because you can migrate data to the cloud. But if you look at ERP systems, you usually have like 5 to 7 years of legacy data, and you need to do something with that. And migrating all of that to the cloud is not a very wise thing to do, because data models don't fit. You are losing the meaning in the processes, because processes work differently. You are losing relationships between data fields, because that is not contained in your cloud system. So you really need to think hard about what you are going to do with the legacy systems. You probably have to keep some of them in place just to deal with the history and make sure that, you know, when authorities come and ask you certain questions, that you are prepared to answer those.
Tell us
a little bit of everything.
Oh, that's great. No, that's fantastic, actually, because I'll tell you, everyone's so white hot over here about the cloud that we don't at this stage, we don't find ourselves actually challenging a lot of the assumptions like y'all are doing right now, which is great. I remember having these discussions in, 2005 and 2006, but everyone rushed to the cloud. And now when you look at the U.S. software market, the HR and recruiting software market, it's at least 85%, SaaS or cloud solutions. So, this is great information. Let's dig into data for a second. I really want to kind of get your take on, the promise of big data, the promise of metrics and analytics and making decisions based on data. And you're dealing with some transitions here around old data, new data, different delivery of software, et cetera. What's been your experience with the HR professionals and their relationship with this data?
it's a complicated relationship. I think, I have to be honest. What we see is that big data is something that has been introduced as sort of a trend over the past, let's say, 2 to 3 years. And HR professionals have a very hard time dealing with that or bringing that back to what I like to call meaningful data, because big data in itself, well, you have a lot of data, you sit on a lot of data as HR, but it does not mean that you need to do something with all that data. There's probably a couple of pockets of information that will be most helpful to your company going forward, but it doesn't make sense to just look at all that data and try to combine all that data, because it will not bring you any value. And actually, what I found very interesting is that, we are all familiar with Google, I suppose. And Google is an experiment in itself in that they they mine all the data that pertains to their HR departments, and they come up with very interesting findings. And one of the most interesting findings recently was that, you know, all those, when people go for interviews, all those things that they ask you, all those word questions, there is nothing that predicts the your suitability for a company as much as when you take your new recruits through a set of behavioral questions. So, you know, your diplomas and the grades that you had are not very good predictors of how successful you will be in this case, Google. The only thing that reliably predicts how successful you are going to be is the answers to behavioral questions. I find that very meaningful results, because those results can also be translated to other companies, to your company, to my company, when we are dealing with recruits. So, you know, looking at those specific types of analytics can be very helpful, looking at all of it and just making sense of all the data that you sit on. I don't think that is very helpful.
What's the HR practitioner, in your experience and your travels, if you can, paint us a picture of the person, male, female, kind of who they are, how they operate. Kind of give us a snapshot into the HR practitioner that you interact with on a day-to-day basis.
I lead a region. My counterparts are mostly VP of HRs or board level of other companies. When I'm in meetings, there's usually also, let's say, the director of shared service centers or the leader of the center of excellence of the company. So I usually meet HR management, not so much practitioners. Having said that, what I think you notice in the companies that I deal with is that we see people move in from other areas of the business. And that's a very interesting development, because they bring fresh looks on things, they bring new skills, and they also help in professionalizing the HR department and the services that HR is providing to their employees. If you look at the whole of Europe, we have very established companies. Many countries have a lot of laws around HR, things that you must do in order to be compliant, and you must report on that, for instance, to several boards and to institutes like health and safety reporting or fiscal and tax reporting. We need to provide reports to employees, to works councils, so it's all very much governed in a way that you have to ensure compliancy with processes and procedures, and we have a lot of those, and there are different per country. Just to give you an idea, if I drive, let's say, 1.5 hours, I'm in a different country to the east. If I drive an hour, I'm in a different country to the south. And HR is completely different, and the people that work for me in the Netherlands are not able to do the same thing, for instance, in Germany or in Belgium that I was just talking about. So it's very varied.
Well, it's funny, you can drive 14 hours across Texas and still be in Texas. You can actually drive on I-20 from Shreveport to El Paso, and it's about, ish 14 hours, and never get out of Texas and spend the entire day driving. So that's frustrating for those non-Texans, I would tell you, but you're still in the United States, but you're still in one state of the United States. I want to dig more into the nuances of these different countries that you interact with, things that you see that are different from country to country in terms of the treatment of HR, the treatment of the workforce, or just kind of some of the subtle, funny things that you see that make the different countries different.
Well, because I travel, I also have employees, I have employees in different countries, so I I travel. And you always have to think very, very hard about what is allowed in one country to discuss and what isn't, how to deal with employees. In several countries, it's very common to not just, tell people about change, but to slowly introduce it and to ask everybody what they think about it and then come to some sort of consensus and then finally decide how we are going to approach this change. In other countries, it's very normal to just announce the change and then say, look, this is what we are going to do. How are we going to do this? And then there's everything in between. And it has the way you deal with bosses can be very different. People in the Netherlands are very outspoken, and they're very – everybody is – even though you're a boss or, a business leader, other people usually feel free to come up to you and say, hey, you are going to do this, but that's really not a good plan because, reason one, two, and three. It's also normal that you listen to that and give that person feedback what you are going to do with those three reasons. In other countries, you have to be very careful because when you are a leader and you say something, people will automatically do that, and they will not tell you that why it cannot work. You have to specifically ask them to give you feedback. So whenever you travel, you have to be very conscious of the cultural differences between the workforce, the people in the workforce, and make sure that you get the right message across, but also treat the people in the right way so they come back to you with what they really think. I think that is one of the hardest things to deal with when you work in Europe, because it's so easy to work from the assumption that, because, it's Europe, people are all the same, and they really, really aren't.
Well, and Anita, kind of to jump back to the data privacy side, I've taken one application or kind of technology platform through this whole Safe Harbor certification uh-huh. process. And what are some suggestions from you on places for HR practitioners and people to start when they're looking to go out of the U.S. and start dealing with potentially expanding into Europe, where should they start? What's the process that you would help say, okay, practitioner, here's a place to start, look here, think about this, just high-level stuff. Any suggestions?
Yes. So the place to start, and it sounds a little bit boring, but there's the European Union has published a directive on data privacy, and it really contains all the information that you need. It explains what you can do and what you cannot do. Now, where it becomes difficult is that some countries apply it as it is, and some have additional rules and additional safeguards in place, and you need to be aware of those as well. What you always need to do is go with the general framework first, and then make sure for each of the countries where you want to do something in Europe that there are no additional safeguards in place that you need to take into account when you do something. Now, the easiest thing if you need to do something in Europe is make sure that your servers are in Europe, whatever it is you want to do is hosted in Europe, your data stays in Europe, because then you have no problems at all. However, if you are using, for instance, a cloud solution, and the cloud solution is, well, all of the cloud solutions that are, that are considered now are in the U.S., usually hosted in the U.S., owned by U.S. companies, then you need to start talking to works councils in each of the countries where you operate, because the good thing is that once the Works Council gives consent that you can use that application, they can give consent for all the employees in that country, and then you're more or less done. The alternative is that you have to ask each and every employee in the country for their written permission, and that is sort of a nightmare, and you don't want to get into that. So talk to the Works Council to make sure that they are informed, make sure that they are engaged early in the process, because they're usually easier to work with if you do that than if you just, if it's a done deal and, you know, you're only going to them to ask for their consent and they have nothing to say about the options that you have. Apart from that, I mean, it sounds like a big deal and you need to take it seriously, but I've never come across a situation where in the end we couldn't manage it. So you have to take it seriously, deal with it, but it's very manageable.
Yeah, I know the one thing that I learned in that process was that there's a lot more closing of feedback loops relative to requesting information, getting an answer, housing that information, and making that information available for audit. That was a gigantic,
yep.
You know, and that's the big piece, that's the big difference from like a U.S. cloud solution, because it was a cloud solution, so there was like extra steps. It wasn't a local, you know, a locally hosted or local install. But that was the difference, that was just a product. I mean, you had to change philosophically. You kind of had to change a little bit of the design and the user interface to accommodate that. So it was manageable. Like you said, it's not a gigantic undertaking, but you take it serious. You do your research, and you have good people helping you figure that out, and it's totally doable.
Yep.
So you live and breathe global HR. So, and we ask this question quite a bit because we just get the range of answers. So, where do you draw inspiration from?
I think Twitter is a big inspiration for me. I opened an account a couple of years ago because I just thought that we were behind in the social media space as a company, but also my employees. And Twitter has been fantastic. There's a lot of people that I interact with, but also the things that people are sharing on Twitter, you know, links to articles or to magazines, interesting discussions. That is where I get a lot of inspiration from, because it's not only the HR space, also other topics that suddenly somebody, you know, introduces a very different topic and you think, hey, it's interesting, and this happens in, for instance, finance, and we should also be able to apply that in HR or something. That is how it works for me usually. And then, of course, it's talking to colleagues, talking to customers. Both of these conversations are usually about how can we solve this problem, or we are going in that direction. What do we need to do in HR to support our future movements? Or just walking around at a customer and seeing something and thinking, wow, this is a really good solution for a problem that another customer has. And, yeah, this is how it works for me.
Well, that's a fantastic answer. Anita, we're out of time. Thank you so much for spending lunch or dinner. Dinner is the case maybe for
dinner
you.
Dinner for me, yes. Yes.
So, one... Wonderful conversation, and want to wish everybody that it happens to be applicable to and or knows somebody it's applicable to, happy Thanksgiving for some Drive-Thru HR crew here, and we will be back, and I'm sure have an amazing guest then. We always do. So, Anita, have a good evening.
Thanks, and happy Thanksgiving to all of you in the U.S.
Thanks, Anita.
Wonderful. All right, folks, we're out of here.